Last month, the Trump administration issued a memo to Congress accusing both NPR and PBS of spreading, quote, radical woke propaganda disguised as news, end quote. Last week, President Trump issued an executive order directing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's board of directors to cease federal funding for NPR and PBS, claiming ideological bias. PBS President and CEO Paula Kerger called it a blatantly unlawful executive order and issued in the middle of the night. Joining me in the studio to help us understand the potential impact of a loss of CPB funding on public media here in our region are my two guests. Paul Westhel is Executive Director of Jefferson Public Radio. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, Mike. Nice to be here.
And Phil Meyer is CEO of the Southern Oregon Public Broadcasting Station. Welcome to the exchange, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, I think I should start by letting the audience know that, well, you're my boss.
Correct.
but there's a separation between the business side of JPR and the editorial side. You don't know the questions I prepared for this interview.
Correct.
Nor did you direct me to what to ask.
You are correct.
So let's start with the elephant in the room, gentlemen. The Trump administration has targeted public media as a public enemy. I want to start our conversation by playing a clip from an interview that NPR CEO Catherine Mara gave to Mary Louise Kelly in April about the potential impact of funding cuts on NPR and PBS.
We have invited our president and CEO, Catherine Mara, to speak with us. How much money is at stake?
In this particular package, it would be all the funds for fiscal year 26 and 27. For public radio in total, that is about $250 million. For public media as a whole, it's a little over $1 billion, including public television.
The central question, what would be the effect on NPR of losing government funding?
The biggest effect would be on the NPR network, which are the 246 stations around the country that you're probably listening to us on right now. Those are our member stations, and they receive about $100 million of the $122 million that goes to public radio every single year. So the big impact would be on rural stations, stations in geographies that are quite large or complex in order to be able to receive broadcast where infrastructure costs are very high. You could see some of those stations really having to cut back services or potentially going away altogether.
NPR gets around 1% of our annual budget directly from the federal government. You're making the point that a lot of our member stations would be hit considerably harder.
That's correct. But generally speaking, most of our operating budget comes from our membership fees, and that's what allow our members to be able to receive programming. It comes from underwriting support. It comes from private donations, individual audience member donations. And that same thing is true for member stations, except federal funding makes up a much bigger percentage of their total budget.
So, Paul, what are your thoughts?
Well, I guess, you know, my thoughts are, you know, as listening to Catherine describe the rural component of federal funding is we're the poster children for that that statement. We've, you know, both Phil's operation at SOPBS and JPR serve this rural community in Southern Oregon and Northern California. We've got the Mountain West, which makes broadcasting way more expensive from an infrastructure standpoint. And federal funding, loss of federal funding is going to have the greatest impact on stations like ours. So it's a threat. It clearly is something to be managed and to be advocated against, and we're going to do the best we can to do that.
And Phil, how's the loss of CPB funding going to affect PBS?
Well, one of the things that people don't realize is 70% of CPB funding goes to local stations by law, and we take those dollars and we maintain rural transmitters, and we do local productions and things like that. It's 37% of this year's budget for us. So any organization that loses a third of its funding is going to change. So the question becomes, of all the attempts to take away funding, what's that percentage going to be? So the EO has one approach. A rumored rescission bill would have another approach. The president has tried to fire three members of the CPB board. The FCC has done some investigations into underwriting with the major markets and the national organizations. So it's kind of hard to pinpoint what's going to happen because there's so many different attacks from different directions.
What would happen if that rescission bill goes through?
That would be the elimination of the $1.1 billion that Congress has already appropriated for fiscal 26 and 27. So that's money that's already been appropriated that would be clawed back. So we would have to build new budgets and find other sources for that revenue.
So what's the differentiation between NPR and PBS?
Well, they're both separate organizations, both separate nonprofit organizations. NPR exists in the radio sphere, produces programs that we purchase, as Catherine Moore explained. And it's sort of, a collective in ways. You know, JPR is committed to covering our local region, and then we have this great partnership with NPR and other members of the NPR network to cover national news, international news, and things that we can't cover ourselves. So it's been a built-up process, a built-up system over the years to have this strong network that enables us to do such good work. And I'll let Phil answer the PBS conversation.
And CPB was created before either PBS or NPR, and CPB has no authority over either organization. They're completely independent. But they were developed in the late 60s, early 70s to do things like infrastructure and pooling resources and to serve the greater good, to serve citizens rather than consumers. So for on the PBS side, we also get programming from the BBC, from other syndicators. We do our own local programming as it is on JPR. But that core, that cornerstone of the CPB money is what you build on when you build your budget.
My guests are Paul Westhel, Executive Director of JPR, and Phil Meyer, CEO of Southern Oregon PBS. You can join this conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, gentlemen, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who describes herself as a white Christian nationalist, told NPR CEO Catherine Maher, quote, "You can hate us on your own dime," end quote. It seems apparent that she's offended by the programming and news coverage of PBS and NPR. Not sure why, but her perspective appears to be shared by President Trump and many of his supporters right here in our region. How do you respond to that belief?
Well, I think, for me, we do a lot of news with our own local news department and have journalistic standards that are very rigorous. And we always believe that our best work comes when we have the strongest viewpoints on multiple sides of issues. I have also participated at the national level with editorial discussions within the NPR sphere as well. And that newsroom is incredibly rigorous in trying to explore the issues of our day in a balanced, objective way that does the best work journalistically that they can. And, I think from a JPR perspective, we get probably about the equal amount of comments that we're too conservative as we're too liberal, which probably to me figures we're probably pretty close to the right spot. So, fact-based news, the Trump administration, I think part of this attack is, we've built this sort of narrative around fake news, calling things fake news that are just things you don't like. So there's this sort of, process that's been placed, I think, to discredit, legitimate journalism organizations like NPR and others around the country. And that's the fear, is that this is part of an overall larger attack on a free press.
So undermine trust in the press itself.
Exactly. Exactly.
And how does that affect PBS?
I would mention, to echo Paul's comments, we mirror the country's demographics, whether it's age, education, income. We serve all viewers. So there are going to be people who complain that we're on the wrong side of issues because we're not taking their position. We're fact-based, and there's many studies that you can point to showing that we are one of the highest fact-based and most trusted institutions in the country, both NPR and PBS and local stations. So for one member of Congress to have an issue with that is one member of Congress's opinion. There are over 500 members of Congress, and this legislation that created public broadcasting was passed by a bipartisan Congress and has been continually funded for almost 60 years. So we represent the entire country, not just one narrow slice of it.
Well, it's interesting because to that point, LBJ signed into law the Public Broadcasting Act in 1967. And between then and now, Congress has changed its mind significantly. What happened?
Well, I mean, there's been lots of debates over the years about funding, federal funding for public broadcasting. But those debates have almost always ended in bipartisan support and preserving funding. The last several Republican administrations, the president's budget started with a zero funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and then ended up mostly at full funding. Because broadly, you know, the budget process starts in the House of Representatives and there's broad public support, as Phil mentioned, based on the citizens' view of NPR and PBS doing excellent work and providing excellent value for the small federal investment that makes up 0.01% of the federal budget. A really small and insignificant amount in the big picture, but important seed money at the local level, especially in rural communities, for us to build on to provide a dynamic service here in the local communities that we serve.
On public television, it always goes back to Mr. Rogers. And this month is the anniversary of his testimony before Congress that preserved the first attack on federal funding for public broadcasting during the Nixon administration. And I've been in public television long enough to have the Newt Gingrich attempt, the Mitt Romney attempt. President Trump in his first term tried to zero out CPB. But Congress, representing the overall general populace, always comes back. And even this year, passed the continuing resolution that had this year's CPB funding fully funded. So that's how our system works, the checks and balances of the different branches of government.
So this is not your first rodeo, and you're optimistic, it sounds like.
It's so hard to try and keep up to date with what's happening. We had some money from the Department of Education pulled back over the weekend that funds children's programming, PBS Kids. So the fact that something came over the weekend, those people were notified Monday morning, they're not working on those projects anymore, that happened in less than 48 hours. It's hard to run an organization, even of our size, much less a national organization, when there's that type of quick changes, drastic changes, 180-degree changes. It's very difficult to manage in that environment.
Well, it's interesting because on one hand, there's a lot of disruption and dispute around national issues. But on the other hand, PBS, the kids programming, I mean, most everyone I know grew up on kids programming from PBS.
And 50% of the children of preschool age do not go to preschool. So PBS Kids is the country's largest preschool. So homeschoolers, families that can't afford preschool, all of those programs are curriculum-based, research-based, and there's research. Kids that grew up with, for example, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, as teenagers, they're still using those lessons they learned, empathy, kindness, understanding, patience. It's one of the reasons why I've worked in public television as long as I have.
Well, my kids can still sing the theme song to Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. So why are they trying to get rid of children's programming? What's the focus on that?
I don't think that's what they're trying to do.
Okay.
I think it's news, public affairs, independent film. It's voices that do not necessarily agree, and even ones that might agree but want different things within their sphere of belief. So, as I said, we represent all people, and we have programs for those people. And invariably, when I'm out in the community, I will talk to somebody, and I can find a program that connects to their interests. So it's whether it's general audience or something specific like science and nature or cooking or how to remodel your house, public television invented how-to programming, do-it-yourself programming. There is some connection to what we do in people's lives. For parents, it's PBS Kids.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here in a moment, but when we come back, I do want to talk about the broad range of programming here at JPR as well. Can you give us a sense of what that is, Paul, before we go?
Yeah, you know, we've built this multi-service model here on the radio side of what we do, which has been really innovative over the years. We've been very entrepreneurial, very ambitious to try to get our signals out into various communities with a lot of confidence in listeners to support the station, which has happened for a long time. So we do classical music on our classics and news service. We do rhythm and news, music discovery, which is sort of new contemporary artists. And we do all news and public affairs on our news and information service. And that's broadcast on a network of about 26 stations and 35 different translators, which are jumping all the mountaintops around Southern Oregon, redirecting signals down to the valleys where the people live.
So, Paul, NPR CEO Catherine Meyer told Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, again, quote, "I actually think public funding ensures that we hold tight to a mission that means reflecting all Americans. Most commercial outlets are able to target certain audiences that they want to reach. We have an actual obligation in our mission and in our funding model to try to serve everyone across the country," end quote. Talk about the mission. You started to talk about, we have three services here at JPR. Talk about the mission of JPR, and we'll get to PBS, serving our region of Southern Oregon and how we try to serve everyone across Southern Oregon and Northern California.
Yeah, I mean, we really are looking at the information and civic needs, civic educational and cultural needs of our citizens. And we're saying, what kind of non-commercial service can we build that's not being provided by the commercial broadcasters that enhance that, that advance that that culture in Southern Oregon and Northern California? So on the civic side, that's bringing in in-depth, fact-based news from National Public Radio that covers national, international issues, contextual news that covers issues, not just kind of, you know, the most scintillating news stories nationwide. On the local level, that means a team of journalists here at JPR. We've worked hard to build our local newsroom in the past several months and years. We have three full-time reporters, a news director, the Jefferson Exchange Unit. There's two full-time people, some part-time people. We operate the largest newsroom now in Southern Oregon. So we're beating the bushes. We're looking at school board agendas. We're doing the work of local journalism to make sure citizens are informed. On the cultural arts side, we're providing music services that wouldn't otherwise be provided by the commercial marketplace. Classical music is not going to have a place on the radio in places like, you know, Ashland and Mount Shasta and Redding and all the small communities of Southern Oregon and Northern California. Music discovery services, again, another opportunity for us to reach out and connect with other cultural organizations like the Brit Festivals and, you know, the New Holly Theater Project that we've been part of. All of these various things to enhance sort of the arts community in Southern Oregon and Northern California, and the opportunities for citizens to know about new artists. So all of those kind of, the gestalt of that is a mission-based, rooted in civic engagement. It's rooted in advancing the artistic and cultural culture of all the communities that we serve.
And it serves somewhat of a public square.
Yeah, exactly. So this program is a great example, right? Every day you talk about issues that are important to people here in Southern Oregon and Northern California. You research those issues. We have a producer that goes behind the scenes to make sure that those programs are fact-based, that we have a real diversity of viewpoints being expressed. All that takes money, and that money results in I think, what's a good public service and excellent programming.
It's a huge benefit to our local region. Phil, talk about PBS and its programming.
Well, the most succinct way I've heard it expressed, and I can't remember, unfortunately, who came up with it, commercial media exists to create consumers. Public media exists to create citizens. So if you look at what we do, education for children, news and public affairs, arts and culture, we are trying to create a better place to live. And that starts with our local service. So SOPBS's mission is very straightforward. As an independent media voice, SOPBS enriches our understanding of the past, enlivens our present, and prepares us for the future by connecting our community with quality local and national programming that educates, enlightens, inspires, and entertains. That's what we do. And we take that federal investment, and it's a different amount for different stations, and we leverage it. It's a public-private partnership. It is something that we go out and find more dollars locally than we receive from the federal government. But that federal government is the starting point. So often when we apply for grants, are you eligible for federal funding? Yes. Are you a nonprofit? Yes. Do you serve this audience? Yes. So we go out and find those funds, and Paul's been very successful in his tenure here expanding the service, and we're starting to do that. This week is 3 years I've been in the Rogue Valley, by the way, and everywhere I've been, that is what public media does. And it's not, we have a sale on spots and you can reach this number of people with your commercial.
Right. And one of the additional pieces, I think one of the huge important pieces that we often don't think about when we talk about local media, particularly public local media, is when things happen in our region, emergencies, catastrophes, disasters, where do we turn?
Right. So I think in this emergency alerting capacity, it's a very kind of under-recognized service that we provide. And, you know, JPR, we learned significantly from the Alameda fires in 2020 and the South Open Chain fires where our plant needed to be beefed up. And we made a big investment in backup power at various locations. Obviously, this facility that we now sit in has backup power for the newsroom and our core broadcast facilities. So that we can stay on the air during public emergencies. We developed a pretty innovative technical system that enables us to interrupt our signals strategically with a north, south, and central geographic area, so we're not alerting people in some areas that are not in the way of a natural disaster or public emergency. So these are big issues, you know, big issues. And what we learned in that circumstance is that radio especially, and I'm sure TV as well, was a great modern wireless technology. Phones were down. The internet was down. So all of these alerting systems, these ISP-based systems that we've built that people were so hot on, didn't work so well. And radio ended up turning to be a pretty darn good mechanism for alerting the public.
And in addition to the emergency alert system, which we're both a part of, which is like a daisy chain system throughout the country, PBS, with its infrastructure, is the backbone of what's called WARN, which is the cellular warning service. So when the cell phones are working, PBS is the backbone of that. And there's been several stories recently. Blue Ridge Public Radio, when Hurricane Helene happened, it was the only local media on the air. So they were doing things like where to find water, where to charge your cell phones, not the national headlines, what you need to survive.
Right.
And that's the basis of what we do, because the federal investment in the infrastructure is being used for those purposes. So there is a use for that $1.60 per year per person that goes to the local stations, because that equipment's not cheap.
Right.
My guests are Paul Westhell, Executive Director of JPR, and Phil Meyer, CEO of the Southern Oregon PBS. Gentlemen, I can't ignore this elephant in the room, so I'm going to jump right into it. The Trump administration uses the term improper ideology in its executive order that was dated on January 29th, which formed the Task Force 250. And the Task Force 250 ensures that schools, libraries, museums, and media are prioritizing curricula and celebrations that underscore the Declaration of Independence, the greatness of America, and reverence for the Founding Fathers. So I wonder if the attacks on media, education institutions, and libraries and museums is part of a coordinated strategy to diminish, dilute, and mute narratives that may call into question or dispute the national narrative that's being promoted by the White House and its networks during this year-long celebration that's coming up in 2026 to reinforce the Make America Great Again ideology.
Well, it's interesting, some of the phrasing. Guess what Ken Burns' next film will be about?
I don't know.
The American Revolution, premiering in November. So we do that, but there's also the First Amendment aspect of this, that there is no one belief or ideology, and the framers of the Constitution thought it was so important they made it the First Amendment, was freedom of the press. So whatever you believe, there is still that fundamental right that we have as citizens and as, at the time, it was the press. But media, whatever term you want to use, we are free to express people's opinions and interview people who have differing opinions. That's what we do.
Representing all the people.
Exactly.
Right. And for me, you know, I always come back to the founders, you know, intent in drafting the Constitution. There's a famous Jefferson quote that says, if I could have a government without a free press or free press without government, I choose the latter, the free press without government. And that's how important an institution the free press is to a democracy. And that's the values that we try to live by every day, that information is really fundamental. Information is power. Information gives democracy energy and choices of people and makes it work. So we invest a lot in the institution of a free press. And I do think that some of these attacks are a way to try to weaken those dissenting what the current administration perceives as dissenting voices.
Well, more than half of the counties across the country are categorized as news deserts. Do you think that this administration's animus toward public media, particularly local public media, could have a permanent impact on the local media landscape?
It already has. So Northwestern University, Medill School of Journalism, did a study after the election, and counties that have news deserts are news deserts, voted for President Trump at 91%.
Wow.
And the margin was something like 40, 50 points in those counties. So there are explanations for other reasons to vote for the president, but that is one of those causation or correlation questions. So not just the presidential election, but just research has shown when there's no local news presence, there's more nepotism, there's more no-bid contracts, there's more fraud in local government because no one is at the commission meeting or the school board meeting and reporting on that. Voting participation goes down. So all this research showing if you don't have a strong local press, your community suffers.
Yeah, I guess for us, we're passionate about trying to be part of the solution. We can't be everything, and we live in an ecosystem that's evolving. You know, newspapers have gotten a lot weaker, and we've seen a lot of volatility in the Rogue Valley media scene and newspaper business. And so we are really working hard to build capacity at the local level. And that's the most expensive work that we do because it takes editors and journalists and fact-checking. And if you're going to do this right, it takes resources. And that's really what my concern is. The rescission order would create a $525,000 hole for us on the budget starting on July 1. So that's 2 months from now. No time to adapt, no time to try to figure out a new kind of way to operate. It's just going to be a big emergency, a big funding emergency. And we're going to deal with it, and we're going to deal with it like we solve every problem. We're going to talk about it. We're going to be creative. We're going to be innovative. We're going to build partnerships. But it's something that we wish we didn't have to do, and it will definitely not help us going forward.
Well, you talked about earlier that we have the largest newsroom in this valley.
Yep.
Who knew that a radio station would have the largest newsroom in this valley? How supportive are the residents of Southern Oregon and Northern California of local media?
Well, I could say for JPR, we're one of the strongest supported stations in the country. When you look at per capita giving in Ashland specifically and in Jackson County as a whole, the per capita giving is in the top, quintile of stations around the country. And when you get to communities like Ashland, we're in the top handful of stations around the country. We raise over $300,000 in Ashland to support this enterprise, which is incredible for a community of 20-some thousand people. So, we're broadly supported. I have no doubt that our service is valued, and we're going to, make a bold case, as we always have, to the public to support what we do and to make sure that we thrive into the future.
And Phil?
SOPBS has 8,000 members, generates a little over $1 million annually. Paul mentioned the difficulty in dealing with such a rescission. If the rescission were filed today, they have a 45-day window to address it in Congress. My next board meeting is before that 45-day window would expire. So I'm preparing two budgets, going to my board, and saying, here are your scenarios, and then we will just have to react to what happens.
So it's a tenuous situation.
Not a good way to run a railroad or a public radio station.
Or TV station.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.